were saying it's wrong, fundamentally wrong, to treat people differently based on the color of your skin or your race, your gender, ethnicity, or national origin. In Michigan, we're requiring equal treatment.
Michigan Attorney General Bill Schuette making the case for Michigan's ban on affirmative action. Well, the Supreme Court voted 6-2 today in support of that ban, a voter initiative that said Michigan's public universities cannot use affirmative action for admissions. Last year, the justices said it was okay for colleges to consider race in their admissions process, but the majority today said it's also okay for states to not consider race. 10 states have ended affirmative action in higher education, including California. And in a moment, we'll talk about how that's affected who gets into the UC system. Joining us now is Greg Storr. He's Supreme Court reporter for Bloomberg and author of the book, A Black and White Case, How Affirmative Action Survived Its Greatest Legal Challenge. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Well, I guess today it didn't survive. So tell us about the decision. What was the case about?
The case, as you said, was about a ballot initiative that said in Michigan, the very state that produced the big ruling 10 years ago that allowed affirmative action, the ballot initiative said, notwithstanding that the Constitution permits it, we, the voters of Michigan, say we don't want our public institutions to consider race in admissions. And the Supreme Court, today said that's okay. They rejected arguments under the Equal Protection Clause that it violated the rights of minorities.
And the ruling was 6-2, so not the usual 5-4 split. Can you tell us about that, why it was so lopsided?
Not quite the usual 5-4 split, you're right, or at least the common 5-4 split. Justice Stephen Breyer, who often votes with the court's liberals, but not necessarily on affirmative action, he is somewhere in the middle on that, went with the five Republican appointees, the five more conservative justices in the majority. And then a fourth Democratic appointee, Elena Kagan, didn't take part in the case, presumably because when she was in the Obama administration, she may have had some involvement in deciding whether the administration would get involved in the case.
So the two dissenting justices were Sonia Sotomayor and Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Sotomayor, she read an impassioned summary from the bench, from what I understand. What did she say?
She did. It was very impassioned. What's interesting, just to back up just a little bit, last term, the court, with only Justice Ginsburg dissenting, issued something of a compromise ruling in a case out of Texas on affirmative action and basically said tougher judicial scrutiny of these programs. And Justice Sotomayor joined that opinion. This time she, and she of course is the court's only Latina justice, this time she was not willing to go along, and she spoke in her own voice. And essentially what she said was that the court was allowing the majority to stack the deck against the minority. And she in particular took Chief Justice John Roberts to task. He has been an advocate of a colorblind constitution, and he has said the way we stop discrimination on the basis of race is to stop discriminating on the basis of race. And she called him out of touch, or called that view out of touch with reality and with the real life faced by minorities in this country.
Right, because from what I understand, she actually was a beneficiary of affirmative action in
her
early life.
She was, and she's a proud beneficiary of affirmative action. She, thinks that without it, minorities still need that to play to get on the level playing field with white people in this country, and so I don't recall if it was her first time dissenting from the bench since she's been on the court, but it certainly was at least one of the first times, because it is a topic that clearly matters a lot to her.
Now, you mentioned earlier that this is the second decision involving Michigan. Why is this such a hot button issue in Michigan, and how does this differ from the earlier case, and what will it mean for Michigan's admissions policies?
I'll start with the last. It actually won't mean anything going forward, because the university had already started complying with the ballot initiative, notwithstanding the fact that a federal appeals court said the ballot initiative was unconstitutional. It all sort of is part of the same thread. there was a lawsuit filed against the University of Michigan. Back in the early 2000s, the university decided we're going to make a real robust defense. That led to the big decision that allowed it across the country, but that also got the people within Michigan, the opponents of affirmative action, it spurred them to action, and they supported and won approval for this ballot initiative. So that ironically, the University of Michigan is one of the places in the country that can't actually benefit, at least in its view, benefit from the big ruling that the university won in 2003.
Well, can other universities?
They can. So other parts of the country, the 40 or so states where universities can, public universities can consider to use, can continue to use race, they still can. This does not affect them unless the voters of their state or perhaps the state legislature does something to ban it as a matter of state law. But for most of the country, it is still the case today that universities can and generally do consider race as one factor in making admissions decisions.
So the court is basically saying, you voters, if you don't like that, feel free to change it.
Right, exactly. You know, that was in Justice Kennedy's lead opinion for the court. That was sort of the theme of it, that this is, yes, this is a really difficult issue. People disagree. It's very emotional. But that's not reason to say that the voters of the state can't deal with this as they see fit. Some states might allow it, and some states like Michigan might say, no, we don't want it.
So are there other states now lining up to get rid of their affirmative action programs?
Lining up is probably too strong. We'll have to see. You know, certainly the opponents of affirmative action haven't been shy in trying to push initiatives where they think they can be successful. In California, is the most prominent example a number of years ago. We'll have to see whether this will spur more of these to go forward. Now that there is no question that if such an initiative is approved, that it would pass constitutional scrutiny.
And so this has been around, as I said earlier. California has been. Well, has banned affirmative action for nearly 20 years, 18 years now. What has been the effect in terms of the student body?
In general, there is some evidence that the numbers of minorities have decreased at those universities that cannot use, at those top universities that cannot use race as an admissions factor anymore. Now, one thing that is happening in some states, including California, and it happens differently in different states, is that states are looking for race-neutral ways of ensuring diversity. And many of them, for example, the case from Texas last year involved what they call the top 10% program, where if you finish in the top 10% of your high school class in Texas, you are guaranteed admission to the University of Texas. It's actually now more like the top 8%. But and that does have the effect of, because it pulls, it ensures that students at predominantly minority, and Texas is mostly predominantly Hispanic high schools, will get a slot at the University of Texas. So that does have some effect on those overall numbers. But those who favor affirmative action say that's not enough, and we're actually not getting the same richness in the diversity that we would get if you let universities actually use their own judgment in determining who to admit.
Right. Well, you can see that here in California, because we're supposed to allow the top 9% into the UC system of high school graduates, and yet it is pretty lopsided, at least when it comes to African Americans. We're going to talk about that in the next interview. Greg Storr, thank you so much for coming on today.
My pleasure.
Greg Storr is a Supreme Court reporter for Bloomberg, author of the book A Black and White Case: How Affirmative Action Survived Its Greatest Legal Challenge. Well, what do you think? Should public universities consider race when deciding whom to admit? You can leave a voicemail, 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can leave a comment on our Facebook page, KCRW's Press Play. Nearly 20 years ago, California banned affirmative action for its colleges and universities after voters adopted Prop 209. And yet the University of California announced that for the first time, more Latinos were offered admission for next fall than whites. Sylvia Hurtado is professor and director of the Higher Education Research Institute at UCLA. Welcome.
Thank you.
All right. So The numbers show that 28.8% of those admitted to at least one UC campus were Latino, compared with 26.8% white and 36.2% Asian American. What do you make of that?
Well, we actually are seeing, at least in California, that the numbers of Latinos are increasing substantially in high schools, and so we're now seeing them actually get admitted to the top universities in state institutions now. And so this demographic surge was predicted a while back, and it's now coming to fruition. As for Asian Americans, we know that they are extremely high achieving, and so we have a large number of Asian American students, obviously, in California, and so we're seeing a large proportion of those students be admitted as well.
And then for African Americans who live in California, just 4.2%. That's what they make up of the those offered admission. That
right.
Seems really low.
Right. The numbers have not been where we would like them to be, and I think we need to work on increasing those numbers. And for every student that is admitted, we want to make sure that they accept our offer.
So what is happening with outreach? Is UC doing a good job, or could it do more in terms of recruiting and making sure that minority students apply and are ready to apply to these schools?
Right. I think UC has really done a great job. We recently removed the achievement tests, which were a huge barrier in terms of taking three tests in addition to the SAT, and that really increased applications dramatically among all groups, and particularly underrepresented groups. We consistently provided public service announcements. We have recruiters, regular recruiters. We have college days on campus, et cetera. So we're doing all we can to increase outreach in that regard. And there's another component of that, and that's really, are the schools equipped to provide adequate counseling? And I think that's always a struggle with budget cuts. So I think there was a bit of a difficulty in terms of meeting everybody's needs in that regard. But I think we also have student volunteers that have been going to schools to work with counselors and students, and that's been very helpful.
All right. So going back to this number of African Americans, UCLA accepted 406 in-state Black students. This is for a freshman class of how many?
It's usually about 4,500 students.
4,500 students.
Mm-hmm.
So 406 African American in-state.
Mm-hmm.
So what does that say to you?
Well, it says that obviously that the students we are admitting are probably among the top in the country, and that's partially because of our race-neutral policies, and so we're not able to go beyond what criteria we use for all students, and so that makes it more difficult to sometimes take risks on students that because of different ways that students show their talents. We try to extend and develop our holistic review so that we take into account many other factors in addition to academics and achievement, but also leadership and also challenges, personal life challenges, etc., and that's taken into account in admissions. But it always helps to also know to be able to target a particular group, and we can't do that in terms of the law of 209.
Banning affirmative action. So there are ways to get around affirmative action in a way, as you just said, but they only go so far.
They only go so far, yes. And so I think we really need to find ways to, I mean, one solution has been to increase outreach, but when we wanted to increase outreach, obviously there was a huge number of budget cuts. So I think currently the President Napolitano actually is interested in really redeveloping a stronger outreach kind of component that actually might come back to where we, our original plans were when 209 was first enacted, was to really have a large comprehensive outreach effort.
Well, at the same time, though, UC is admitting a lot more undergraduates from outside California and outside the United States. 13% of all undergraduates are from outside California this year, as compared to just 5% 4 years ago. And obviously, that's a budgetary issue, right? I mean, they pay $23,000 a year more per student than an in-state student.
Yes. California was among the states, probably had the lowest number of out-of-state students of any public institution. And so the 95% were residents. And we used to get funding for those students, obviously. When funding starts to get reduced, obviously, then there's other ways you still have some capacity. And so when you have capacity, you can include out-of-state residents. So yes, the out-of-state students do provide additional income, as do international students, for all campuses. And campuses thought of this as a way of making sure that we were able to meet costs and without raising costs for residents.
But those are spots that could be taken by in-state residents and minority students.
Yes, that part of that is true, but we also only provided enough funding for a certain number of spots. So, in other words, when funding is reduced, there are fewer spots that can be sponsored by the state, and so their institution may still have capacity to increase, to have, for example, slightly larger classes, et cetera.
Sylvia Hurtado, Director of the Higher Education Research Institute at UCLA, thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up on the program, there are now around 7 billion people on the planet in the next several decades. There will be 9 billion. How will we feed all those people without destroying the Earth? Answers coming up on this Earth Day on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. By 2050, there will be 9 billion people on Earth. Question one, just how are we going to feed all those people? Which leads us to question two on this Earth Day. How do we feed 9 billion people without destroying the Earth? There is heated debate when it comes to that second question. Conventional farming may be able to produce enough food, but critics say that's not good for the environment. But can organic farms keep up with population growth? Well, Jonathan Foley's been pondering this dilemma as his role as director of the Institute on Environment at University of Minnesota, and he's put together a guide to feeding 9 billion for National Geographic. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
All right, so let's get into this debate, conventional agriculture versus organic local farming. Which way do you tilt, or which way should we be tilting?
Well, first, I don't think it should be an either-or proposition. I think both systems have tremendous merits. For example, we know that, you know, that organic systems actually have a lot of wisdom in them in terms of managing pests and managing better soil conditions and so on, using far fewer or no chemicals, which is really advantageous in many, many ways. But organic is also, you know, sometimes more expensive and harder to scale up for certain kinds of crops. And I think there are some advances in conventional agriculture that are worth keeping as well, like using high-precision GPS units, kind of more precision agriculture. There's a lot of advances there as well that are really worth exploring. So I'd like to see, instead of a, you know, us versus them, kind of it's either one or the other, could we find kind of interesting hybrids of the two, kind of taking the best of the organic approaches and some of the conventional, and seeing what we could do to improve all of our agriculture, not just part of it.
But the fact remains that we just can't keep cutting down forests to make room for big agricultural concerns, correct? I mean, how much more rainforest can we stand to lose?
Well, that's correct. I mean, the real issue here is that agriculture altogether is really one of the biggest things that we do to hurt the environment in some ways. You mentioned deforestation. Right now, all the land in agriculture on Earth occupies about 40% of all the land on the planet. If you add up all of our cropland and all of the pasture we use to grow food, it's like an Africa and a South America's worth of land, or 40% of all there is. That's huge, and it's expanding in places we don't want to expand, like tropical rainforest with its biodiversity and all of the carbon that's there. But also, agriculture is the biggest consumer of water in the world, and it's one of the biggest contributors to climate change as well, emitting carbon dioxide, methane, and other gases that warm the planet. So agriculture is a huge issue when it comes to sustainability and preserving the future of the environment, and that means we have to get it right.
And then you also write that just around half of the crops we grow go to feed us, and the rest go to feed animals and other things.
Well, here's how that works. Yeah, right now about, well, it's kind of two steps. We grow a lot of crops on Earth, like, you know, rice and wheat and corn and soybeans and all those things we all know and love, right? But a lot of those are fed to people, about 55 to 59% roughly. And then the rest are fed mainly to animals, which we do eventually eat, you know, milk and, you know, meat products and things from those animals, but at very low efficiencies. They can't turn those crops into hamburgers and milk with 100% efficiency. It's just not possible. And increasingly, we're turning some of our crops into biofuels, too, like ethanol and other things around the world. So it's not only how much food we grow, it's also how we choose to use it. Do we want to use all of our crops to grow animal products, which we might like, but it's not as efficient, usually, as growing crops that we eat directly? And what about biofuels? Can we afford to use, you know, food crops to grow things to put in our gas tanks? That's a question we really have to consider and what the trade-offs there are. But even beyond that, on top of how we use crops to feed people, animals, and cars, we end up wasting about 30 to 40, sometimes even 50% of all the food in the world, whether it's vegetarian or meat, because it's just never consumed. It's wasted by consumers, it's lost in the supermarket, it spoils somewhere along the way, or it rots in a farmer's field. And that food waste is a huge opportunity. So interestingly, to feed more people, we might be able to do a lot with the food we already grow, but we have to really address the issues of food waste first and foremost, but then also our choices around diets and biofuel policy might also need to be on the table.
These seem like huge changes in our behaviors that we would have to implement on a grand global scale.
Well, I mean, a lot of those things are happening already, right?
Mm-hmm.
As people around the world are getting wealthier, China, India, and other countries are eating a lot more meat. They're kind of looking towards our diets and emulating those. At the same time, us in the West, we have, you know, kind of obesity epidemics and, you know, issues related to our diets. We know that maybe we're overdoing it with certain things. So maybe we need to, you know, look at positive ways to influence diet that help our health and our environment and our health, our food security long term. It's clear that our diets can change, but can we change them for the better, not just, changing them for the worse, which seems to be what we do a lot of sometimes.
Right. So how do we convince people who are becoming more prosperous in the developing world not to eat as much meat or not to want to eat as much meat and dairy as we do?
Well, that's pretty difficult for Americans to do, considering what we eat. It's a little bit hypocritical for us to tell other folks, no, don't eat what we eat because that would be bad for the planet. You know, that's probably not a good way to start. But I do think it's important to work both on our current, like, U.S. diets and other countries that eat a lot of high, rich diets that are high in meat and dairy products and other things, to see what we can do to improve our health and our sustainability. And then also, you know, see what can be done in countries that are transitioning quickly to a more intensive diet, to really show not kind of a scolding kind of attitude, but rather, you know, hey, this will be better for you in the long run. This might be healthier, might avoid health care cost. Other burdens society eventually has if people are eating maybe things that aren't too healthy for them. So it's really, that's a very difficult thing, but I think it's one that we'll eventually get to. In the U.S., actually, we are seeing big changes in consumption of beef, for example, is down while chicken is going up. People, I think, are shifting their diets related to health concerns and other things. We're seeing a big rise in the interest of kind of local and organic kinds of produce and on the fruits and veggies end of the spectrum. That's really quite heartening. You see Walmart now getting into the organic business, which, you know, some people may not like, but would it have the effect of making organic more inexpensive and more available to people who not just those at the, you know, higher ends of the income bracket? So some very interesting things are happening. So we'll have to watch and see what happens more.
So you're saying that these recommendations would be, if they were implemented, that you've outlined, these five recommendations, would do enough to feed 2 billion more people in the next three decades?
Well, let me step back and we need to think about what the challenge really is. Yes, the population growth is part of the problem. Like, we have 7 billion people now, and if we don't curb our population growth further than we have already, we'll probably be around 9 billion by middle of the century. That isn't a given, though. We can do a lot to curb population growth. Maybe that number could be 8 instead of 9. You know, what can we do to kind of mitigate that? So those aren't predictions. They're just kind of projections of what we're doing now. But also, as the world gets wealthier, there are 3 to 4 billion people in the world already here who are eating richer diets. places again like China, India, Brazil, Russia, and others, as they get much wealthier and create a global middle class, there are more and more people eating rich diets. And that turns out to be a bigger kind of driver of food demand than population growth, at least lately. So that's pretty interesting. But together, population growth, which would add about 25 to 30% more food demand to the world, and diet changes, which might be another 60%, you add those together, you get close to about a doubling of global food demand by mid-century if we don't change our behavior. So the first thing we need to do is see if we can change our behavior. Can we change our diets? Can we change the projected population growth? Those things are important. But then, yeah, the outlined steps that we talk about in this National Geographic article are the things you would have to do at a minimum to figure out how to get enough calories into the world's diet for 9 billion people who want to eat more, but also to preserve as much as possible of the environment. And so we talk about eliminating deforestation, improving drastically the efficiency of agriculture, and learning more from things like organic systems instead of such widespread use of chemicals, energy, and water, and also reducing our food waste and dealing with diets. So those are things we think we can do, right, and that we necessary.
All right. And you have to check it out, listeners, at nationalgeographic.com. Also some amazing pictures to go along with the article by Jonathan Foley, Director of the Institute on Environment at the University of Minnesota. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, are you experiencing true detective withdrawal? We have some recommendations for underappreciated serial killer films on Press Play after this news update with KCRW's Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
I don't want to know anything anymore. This is a world where nothing is solved. Someone once told me time is a flat circle. Everything we've ever done or will do, we're going to do over and over and over again. And that little boy and that little girl, they're going to be in that room again. And again, and again, forever.
The recent HBO series True Detective was a big hit, one of the most watched seasons in HBO history. And the DVD and Blu-ray of the first season will come out June 10th. Until then, for those passionate fans of gritty serial killer detective movies, we have some suggestions brought to you by TV writer and film historian Mark Jordan Ligon. Hi.
Hi there.
So were you a True Detective fan?
Oh, big True Detective fan. I, like millions of others, I devoured it weekly when it was on. And I'm here today to highlight a few nuggets of the serial killer genre that might be under a lot of people's radar. I mean, obviously, there's tons of the famous and high-profile ones. Silence of the Lambs, Monster, Manhunter. But we're going to discuss some of the best and least known of this genre.
Okay, beginning with?
Well, let's start with 1995's impressive Citizen X.
Mm.
Now, this was an HBO original movie, and it's a true story, and it focuses on how difficult it was for Russian detectives to catch this ruthless serial killer who roamed the train stations in the rural countryside throughout the 1980s. And Stephen Ray, who you might remember from The Crying Game and many other great films, he plays the newly hired forensic scientist who confronts a tribunal of government officials with the reality of a recent rash of missing children.
It's clear that we have a serial killer on our hands, already the most prolific in Russian history. We'll have to take extreme methods to stop him.
Did he say a serial killer?
We understood there were wide discrepancies between the wounds inflicted.
It's what you told us, Coroner.
And both boys and girls.
It could be two different men.
It could be a gang.
There are no serial killers in the Soviet state. It is a decadent Western phenomenon.
That's worth the price of admission.
Isn't that amazing?
Who is that?
Well, that actually was Joss Ackland, who's also a great character actor, saying that. But, I mean, so interestingly, Soviet authorities didn't even want to admit that such a thing could even exist. And because of this, the hunt for the killer dragged on for over 7 years. But luckily, Ray finally finds a sympathetic military official played by the excellent Donald Sutherland. And here Sutherland explains to Ray how things work in Russian bureaucracy.
The reason they said no to your demands? To ask for more men, or computers for that matter, is to admit to our superiors in Moscow that we are overwhelmed, which they will never do. To ask the FBI for help is to admit to the West that we are behind in both forensic techniques and managing information, which they will never do. And to publicize the case is to admit that such crimes exist in the Soviet Union, which is the one thing they would rather die than do. Publicly admit that anything is wrong. The only way that I have been able to get anything done is behind closed doors.
Quite deservedly, Sutherland won an Emmy and a Golden Globe for this terrific work in this very powerful film. Again, it's called Citizen X.
And in real life, did they catch the serial killer?
Yes, they did.
Oh, I just ruined the film.
No, but it's okay. But yeah, no, he is sadly the most prolific serial killer in Russian history. It's a fascinating film because Stephen Ray is based on this real forensics detective in the early days of forensics, and he was up against so many people trying to make his job harder than it needed to be.
Next.
We're going to go to the exceptional South Korean feature from 2010, I Saw the Devil. And it stars Cho Min-sik. He's the acclaimed star of the award-winning film Old Boy.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
And he's...
This is a cult favorite.
Yes, and it's one of the greatest performances I'd ever seen.
Remade by Spike Lee recently.
Yes. Not very good remake, by the way. But the original, for those people who haven't seen it, is amazing. And the guy who plays Old Boy, he is the serial killer in this movie. And it's no surprise because we know right away he is. And 20 minutes into the film, he's caught by the police detective who now knows his young wife was one of Cho's victims.
I have no idea what he just said, but
I'm hooked. For our listeners who do speak Korean, they'll know he said, I am the beginning of your nightmare.
Ooh.
And the interesting thing is the reversal here. The detective, and this is a really compelling aspect of the story, instead of just killing the guy or arresting him, he is going to make it his life's goal to toy with this man and make him suffer and psychologically torture him. So it's this cat and mouse game with shocking violence and amazing performances.
The movie is I Saw the Devil. Did it have theatrical release here?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
What else do you have?
The next underrated flick in this genre is from 1987, White of the Eye. A series of gruesome murders causes an Arizona housewife, played by Kathy Moriarty, to begin to worry that her husband, who installs sound systems into wealthy people's homes, may just be a suspect. And sure enough, the police stop by to question him.
Let me ask you this, Paul. Do you still hunt?
No. Why?
Well, I heard you had quite a reputation. Very heavy into hunting.
Well, yeah, I used to, but I quit when I got married. My wife, yeah. You know, women are.
Yeah. Yeah. Except when they want a fur coat, right? Did you ever meet Joyce Patel?
Joyce Patel. That's the woman that... Oh, man, I never saw her.
Ew, it sounds really creepy.
This is a very trippy, unsettling movie, and it has quite a cult following, mostly because of the director, Donald Cammell. He is a tragic figure of cinema. He only made 4 films, and after his last one was taken away from him and recut by the producers, he became so despondent in 1996, he took his own life.
Mm. Okay, so that's White of the Eye, and you have one more, or a series of one more.
Yes, absolutely. We're going to close with one of the best pieces of British television I have ever seen. It's called the Red Riding Trilogy, and it was shown in the UK as 3 separate TV movies in 2009. And they were so well received, they each got a theatrical release here in the States. And each movie is distinguished by the year the events take place. So the first one, a whole movie onto its own, was 1974. And then the next one was called 1980. And then the third and final one is 1983. And the first one in 74 starts with a young journalist played by Andrew Garfield, who is our most recent Spider-Man.
Mm-hmm.
And without any kind of Spidey sense, he plays a journalist who's trying to uncover the truth about some missing children. And what he discovers is a deep, deep pool of corruption, both within the police force and the surrounding business community.
What sort of man do you think is committing these murders?
The killer they call the Yorkshire Ripper.
The Yorkshire Ripper has claimed his 13th victim.
This man has to be caught.
Garfield refuses to stop the investigation and begins to interview the parents of the missing children.
I'm a journalist.
I'm doing this article about parents and children who have gone missing.
Do you feel that the police could have done anything more to have helped you?
Yeah, there was one thing.
Right, what was that?
They could have found my daughter.
Now, the voice of the bitter mother there is the wonderful actress Rebecca Hall,
mm-hmm.
who is in Vicky Cristina Barcelona, and she's just a terrific actress. In fact, the miniseries is chock full of great British actors. Sean Bean, Game of Thrones, David Morrissey, who's in The Walking Dead, Jim Carter, who's Mr. Carson in Downton Abbey, and Paddy Considine. And in the second film from 1980, Paddy Considine, plays a new detective who has been brought in to try and solve the case, and he's determined to find out who the Yorkshire Ripper really is.
I'll take 78, 79, and Laura Baines. Okay, listen. The Yorkshire Ripper's name's in those files. Trust me, we've had him in and let him go.
What makes you so sure of that?
Well, here's the problem, Bob. You've been looking for some hunchback lorry driver with a Geordie accent, flesh between his teeth, and hammer in his back pocket.
Who do you think we should be looking for, then?
Before this latest, he was quiet for 15 months, right?
Makes you wonder what he was doing all that time.
Exactly. What do you do in your spare time, Bob?
Just like True Detective, it really shows the toll such investigations take on the men and women who are out there every day dealing with the evil that men do.
The evil that men do.
Yes.
Well, that should be a genre in and of itself.
Yes.
But really, the British detective drama or series, those are well regarded in general. I mean, there are a lot of really good ones. Prime Suspect, for example.
In fact, absolutely. There were a lot more that I could have pulled from, and Prime Suspect from 1991 with the great Helen Mirren is a perfect example of that.
So it's interesting that this is crossover TV film.
Absolutely.
A lot of these.
Yes. And, you know, and I understand, you know, even though people really enjoy True Detective, I know some people are disturbed by the whole subject matter, but they just have to look at it in the perspective that this is no more disturbing than, say, for me and my friends to go see Bride Wars or 27 Dresses. So it's all the way you look at things.
There's some real murder that can happen in those bridal showrooms.
Bride Wars was scarier than True Detective. You can quote me on that, Madeline.
So, Mark, let's recap all the movies you talked about in case people weren't writing them down.
Yes. Citizen X.
Citizen X you started with.
I Saw the Devil, South Korean.
Mm-hmm.
White of the Eye, and then the Red Riding Trilogy.
All of which you can get online at
and
your
DVD,
local video store.
Absolutely.
Great. And if you weren't writing it down that time, you can go online at kcrw.com. Go to the Press Play blog. We'll have a list right there. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you.
Mark Jordan Ligon is a film historian and TV writer here in Los Angeles.
From the dusty mesa, a looming shadow grows, hidden in the branches of the poison creosote. She twines her spines up slowly towards the boiling sun. And when I touched her skin, my fingers ran with blood.
The handsome family here at KCRW, and the handsome Warren Olney here.
Oh, how lovely. Thank you so much for saying that.
Nobody can see me, of course, so they can't check you
out.
So
they have to trust my judgment.
We're going to be talking about the Keystone XL pipeline today, and each side, of course, is accusing the other of the evil that men and perhaps women as well do. We'll hear about a cowboy and Indian teepee that's being set up on the Washington Mall in that context, and I'm not going to tell you what that's about until you listen
to
the program.
To listen. Oh, I like that. Okay, so that's coming up at 1 o'clock. To the Point, and Warren Olney. And coming up on this show, will Hillary Clinton run? Will Chelsea? Will her unborn baby? We're going to look at the enduring power of political dynasties in American politics next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Hillary Clinton is considering another presidential run. Daughter Chelsea has said she might run for office someday. And Chelsea just announced that she's pregnant. So there's already speculation that maybe her unborn child could be a future politician. Is there a Clinton political dynasty in the making, like the Bushes and the Kennedys? And would that be a good thing or a bad thing? Jamel Bowie writes about politics for Slate.com, and he recently wrote a story about American political dynasties. Welcome.
Hello.
Well, your thesis is that this is not a new thing at all. We talk a lot about the Bushes and the Clintons and then also the Kennedys, but it goes back further than that, right?
Right. It goes back all the way to the beginning of the United States itself. If you look at the signatories of the Declaration of Independence, you have, the Constitution, you have a large number of men who came from prominent families, often families with deep political connections. You had the Pinckneys of South Carolina, who would go on to become governors of South Carolina, senators, House members. You have James Madison, who is son of one of the wealthiest landowners and tobacco growers in Virginia. You had, I just lost the name of another guy, but it suffices to say that you had a lot of people working on the Constitution who were part of dynasties themselves. And you had, you know, the second president of the United States, John Adams, would go on to be sort of the patriarch of a political dynasty that would last pretty much to the end of the 19th century.
Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, it's interesting, though, that the United States was founded on this idea that we're breaking away from the monarchy and from this kind of hereditary leadership, and yet we seem to be attracted to it.
Right. Well, I think it's important to see that the founding fathers, many of them, they weren't necessarily advocates for the sort of radical individualism that we tend to associate with the period. They were elites. They were interested in protecting their property, and their complaint with the English crown wasn't so much that their individual rights are being violated in the way we would understand them, but that the crown was violating their liberty as Englishmen and violating their property rights, and so on and so forth. And so It really shouldn't come as a surprise to see that the architects of the United States would also, you know, perpetuate or be a part of or support political dynasties.
But fast forward to the present time, to modern times, and it still seems like we haven't ditched this idea.
Not at all. And it makes sense, right, that in the same way that there are families that are in particular businesses and particular professions, there are families that end up making politics what they do, and they maintain these connections throughout generations. And so, you know, when you have, in the case of the Bushes, when you have Prescott Bush, who was a senator, and then George H.W. Bush, who served in government throughout his life and who had three sons who saw their father working in government and running elections, it shouldn't come as a surprise that the sons would also want to do the same, which is why I wouldn't be shocked if a decade or two decades from now, we have Chelsea Clinton running for office. She has two parents who are accomplished politicians, and it would fit in the same way that Michelle Nunn in Georgia is following her father, Sam Nunn, or Jason Carter, also in Georgia, is following his grandfather, President Carter.
Right, and the Cheneys as well. Well, if Hillary runs and then Jeb Bush runs, we could have another Clinton-Bush battle for the presidency in 2016. But here's what Barbara Bush had to say about that in an interview with C-SPAN earlier this year.
If we can't find more than two or three families to run for high office, that's silly, because there are great governors and great eligible people to run. And I think that the Kennedys, Clintons, Bushes, there are just more families than that. Although there's no question in my mind that Jeb is the best qualified person to run for president. But I hope he won't, because I think he'll get all my enemies, all his brothers, all, and their other families. I refuse to accept that this great country isn't raising other wonderful people.
Right. They might be raising other wonderful people who are not running for office. So why is it that we keep going back to the same pool over and over again?
So I think we're actually in a bit of an unusual period. For starters, Hillary Clinton, if she runs, would be, again, one of the few women to ever attempt running for president. And she's sort of in a very unique position. There's really never been any other woman like her in politics before. And likewise, the phenomena of the first president, Bush, having, two sons who could also serve as president is pretty unusual. My guess would be that if, let's say, 2016 is another Bush-Clinton run, and then 2020 would be have at least one Bush or one Clinton on the ticket. After that, we'd probably have, a decade or two decades without either a Bush or a Clinton in presidential politics. We just happen to be in this period where there are two families that are very prominent. In the same way, in the middle of the 20th century, we were in a period where you had two prominent families on both sides of the divide, the Kennedys and the Tafts, who, the Tafts were in national politics for basically the entire first half of the 20th century.
Well, there are plenty of Romneys who might want to run for office, too, in the future.
That's also true. We might hit like a bumper crop of Romney presidential candidates in a couple years.
Well, okay, so what does this say in terms of, the Romneys are very rich? What does this say about wealth and the fact that wealth really plays into, you have to have a lot of money to run for office, and very few people who run for national office start off poor?
Right. I mean, I think, using the Romneys as an example, I think if there's any problem with all of this is that it does highlight the extent to which you need really an immense amount of wealth to get off the ground in politics. And not so much for presidential politics, because by the time anyone's running for president, they already have these deep fundraising networks that sort of make the issue of personal wealth less relevant. Barack Obama, for instance, didn't have a huge amount of personal wealth when he ran in 2008. It's more that when you are trying to get on the ground floor, either running for a House seat or a state Senate seat or for the governorship, if you come from a clan of politicians, then and you have money especially, then all of a sudden party leaders don't have to worry about a huge number of things. They don't have to worry so much about fundraising. They don't have to worry so much about vetting because they already know your family. And much in the same way that incumbency for a run-of-the-mill politician offers a lot of advantages, belonging to one of these families offers many of the same advantages. And that is a problem, right? But that does sort of limit the space for people to run for office and eventually put themselves in the position to run for the presidency.
Well, and also they start with name recognition. So when you have an electorate that, by and large, is pretty apathetic, doesn't turn out to vote very much, name recognition could do an awful lot to help people.
Right. You see in Georgia and in Kentucky where Alison Leonard and Grimes is running that they're both presenting themselves as unique candidates for supporting and trying to suggest to voters that, listen, you like my dad, you'll like me too.
So do you think that we can benefit from dynasties in any way? I mean, this accumulated political knowledge over the generations, could that be a good thing?
I think it could be a wash, I suppose. Some members of political dynasties have gone on to do great work. There's the Udalls in out west who have done very well in politics. being sort of influential in the crafting of policy and sort of responsible lawmakers. You can say the same for the Romneys. You can say this. You can to a similar extent say the same for the Bushes. I'm sure I can't think of any off the top of my head, but I'm sure that there are members of political dynasties who have been, you know, on the opposite side of that and have not been particularly, fruitful as lawmakers. So I think, you know, you have the potential in the same way that for sort of anything, you have the potential for a good side and a bad side. You do have the potential for good things to come out of this, you know, a legacy of public service throughout generations can yield a lot of dividends for the country. Or you could have someone who benefits from all of this but doesn't really do anything with it.
Jamelle Bouie writes about politics for Slate.com. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Of course, we have our own political dynasty here in California with the Browns. We've got Pat Brown, Kathleen Brown, Jerry Brown, of course. He's a dynasty into himself.
We'll see if the Schwarzeneggers do any of
right,
that.
Right, right. Exactly. So a dynasty of one sitting across from me.
Dynasty of one.
Joel Myers.
I am here with the feedback, the dynasty of listeners. So we talked about scratching our true detective itch.
Uh-huh.
I actually have a kind of a high bar for finding serial killers entertaining. It kind of creeps me out a little bit, but I loved the British drama The Fall with Gillian Anderson. She's perfect.
I've heard great things about that.
So
yeah.
Good. Well, we asked you to weigh in. What are your favorite serial killer TV shows and movies? Mike Stratton votes for Silence of the Lambs, to which I say, duh.
It puts the lotion in the basket.
That's what they make me do every time before the feedback. Pete Nichols says he likes the show Hannibal on NBC. And as far as movies, he likes Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer, Manhunter, the 1931 thriller M, and The Brute Man from 1946. Not creepy at all that he has a list that actually went on even longer than that. Not creepy. Not creepy at all. So thanks, Pete,
people
for weighing in.
People have their passions.
People have their passions, apparently.
Okay, Jelly Myers, thank you for that. If you'd like to weigh in with any of your passions, we'd love to hear them. You can leave us a voicemail at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can leave a comment on our Facebook page, KCRW's Press Play. We're on Twitter, at KCRW Press Play. I am at The Mad Brand. We're on All Nade to the Point, up next at 1 o'clock. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.